You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto, and for the rest of the hour, we're going to be taking a look back at some of the scientific breakthroughs of the last century. Talk amongst yourselves. What do you think they are? What would you say? Of course, you would include Einstein, right, and his relativity theories. But what about the discovery of hormones by two men operating on a dog in a small London laboratory? Well, we'll talk about why that's important. Or how about the discovery of the structure of DNA, right? You'd put that in there. Or proteins, or the smallest element of matter, all scientific discoveries that have had a profound effect on how we see the world. How much different would our lives be without antibiotics? Let's chalk that up. I think that's another great 20th century achievement. Well, my next guest has gathered his top picks of the 20th century in science, and they are presented along with the original scientific papers in a new book. And this is quite interesting because if you always wondered what the original papers looked like, I have, and you get the chance to see them all in one spot. Dr. Alan Lightman is a physicist and a writer. He is adjunct professor of humanities at MIT. His new book, Where All the Stuff Can Be Found, is called The Discoveries, The Greatest Breakthroughs in 20th Century Science. And he joins us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
One of the things that you mention in the book is that so few of today's younger scientists have ever seen the original works of the science that they're working in.
Yes. Well, it's not just the younger scientists. It's the older scientists as well. There's this mythology in science that you don't really need the original papers, that the essence of science is the final equation that can be rederived, or the experiment that can be reproduced anywhere in the world, and so the original papers aren't that important. You just need a textbook summary of the papers, and that sort of distinguishes science from all other disciplines like literature and philosophy and history, where you would never dream of not reading the original papers.
Right, you'd read the classics if you were studying literature.
That's right.
You're not reading the classics in science.
Right. Even professional scientists rarely read the literature in their field if it's older than 10 years.
And how, I mean, amongst the humongous, to coin a scientific word, amount of research that went on in the 20th century, how did you narrow it down to just a few dozen choices like that?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't claim that my two dozen discoveries in my book are the greatest discoveries in science in the 20th century. That would be foolish. There's a certain amount of subjectivity that comes in when judging great works of art or great works of science. But I would say that the two dozen I chose all had very profound impact on our view of ourselves and our place in the universe. I picked only two dozen because I wanted to finish the book in my lifetime. And the way that I arrived at the two dozen, I started by discussing the matter with my colleagues in physics, chemistry, biology, and astronomy, and got their nominations for the greatest discoveries in their field in the 20th century. And I got a list of maybe 100 discoveries, and then I winnowed that down using criteria of which discoveries had an impact and meaning that went beyond the original science that they came from, and which discoveries had good human stories, because the human stories of these scientists are also extremely interesting.
You've got, just to go through the list of some of the authors here, you have Max Planck, Albert Einstein, Ernest Rutherford, Niels Bohr. It goes on and on and on. Krebs was an interesting story. Tell us about that one.
Well, Krebs discovered the set of biochemical reactions by which energy is liberated from food, and it's a cyclical process. You start off with some carbohydrates or proteins, and you put in some chemicals. You go around a circle, and then you regenerate the chemicals that you started off with. So it's a replenishing, cyclical set of reactions. It's called the Krebs cycle, and most biochemistry students will study it in college. What interests me about Krebs' story is that he overcame great discouragement from both his father and his scientific mentors. When he was a teenager, his father told him that he was only of very modest intelligence, and I think the quote, what his father said to him actually was that you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. And you can imagine being told something like that by one of your parents and having the courage to get up out of bed the next morning.
Yeah, I can imagine. But you also did not include the technological breakthroughs. Why did you leave technology out?
Well, you have to leave something out if you want to finish the book. And so I decided
second lifetime you needed.
That's right. When we invent a drug that will allow me to live several lifetimes, I will include technology.
Okay. Well,
so I was just practical. For practical purposes, I left out all applied science and all technology and just focused on pure science.
Were there any the discoveries that these scientists made? What I found interesting is that the characters, the scientists themselves, went about their searches in different ways. They have sort of different patterns of how they work.
Yeah. I was trained as a physicist, and I know how physicists work. They break a problem into smaller and smaller pieces until they get down to a very, very simple model, like a spring bouncing up and down. And believe it or not, there's a great deal of physical phenomena that can be reduced to the equivalent of a ball on a spring bouncing up and down. They have a physicist in general have a reductionist view towards the world, whereas biologists think more in terms of concepts and systems. With the exception of molecular biology, a biologist deals with interacting pieces that form a basis for a living organism, and there's only so far you can reduce a system until you don't have life anymore. And so whereas a physicist would be excited about an individual electron orbiting a single proton in an atom, that has very little meaning for a biologist. A biologist would want to look at molecules and groups of molecules transporting proteins in and out of a cell and that kind of thing. So that's a fundamental difference in the way that biologists and physicists view the world.
Yeah, let's talk about the structure of DNA. You say the Nature paper by Watson and Crick is arguably the most important paper in biology in the 20th century.
Yes.
And
well, if you go to a library and you look up that particular volume of Nature in 1953 and look for the Watson and Crick paper, you'll also often find that it's ripped out of the volume like a stone taken out of one of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, that it's considered to be that precious. I would argue that the paper by Rosalind Franklin, which came only two pages later in the same volume of Nature, is also a precious paper because she really helped discover the structure of DNA with Watson and Crick. Both of their papers, the Watson-Crick paper and the Franklin paper, were only two or three pages long, and it's amazing when a communication that short can cause a revolution in science.
1-800-989-8255. Let's try the phones. John in Royal Oak, Michigan. Hi, John.
Hi, Professor. It's a real honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
I've got. I'm curious about whether you've included mathematical developments from the 20th century, because there have been a number of those, including chaos theory and especially algorithm theory, since computers didn't even exist until, 1950 or thereabouts.
Right. I excluded mathematics for the same reason I excluded technology, that there was just a limit to how much could be covered in a book. But if I had included mathematics, I would certainly include the work of Gödel and Turing and people like that.
Did you cover nuclear science as many times as the number of names that were on Ira's list?
Nuclear science was certainly covered. I didn't hear Ira's list, but Ernest Rutherford discovered the nucleus of the atom in 1912, and Lisa Meitner and Otto Hahn discovered nuclear fission in the late 30s, so I had those two discoveries.
Right, and that dates back into the 19th century, because I think Rentgen was the guy that discovered X-rays in the 1890s. Am I right about that?
That's correct. I started in 1900, so I did not include Rentgen or Marie Curie or those works. To me, what was important is not the particular discoveries that I included, but the patterns that I was looking for. I really am very interested in what is the creative process in science, and are there common patterns of discovery in science? And I did find some common patterns, and that was of most interest to me.
What patterns did you find?
A pattern that I found most commonly is a sequence of events in which first the scientist has a prepared mind, has done all of his or her homework. There really are no examples that I know of in the 20th century where great discoveries in science were made by untrained amateurs. So you begin with a prepared mind. You're working hard on a problem, and then you get stuck. That's the second step, which seems to be critical in many discoveries, getting stuck. A lot of our younger people feel that when they're stuck, it's a bad thing, that they give up. But actually, I have found that getting stuck is a marvelous catalyst to the imagination and to the creative process. It's actually a good thing. Somehow the subconscious mind works when we're stuck. And then the next step is a change in perspective or viewpoint when we look at a problem in a different way. And then finally, the discovery. And that sequence of events appears to be universal in the creative process. I've read accounts of writers and painters and actors who describe their creative process, and it often follows that sequence of events.
1-800-989-8255. Leslie in Hillsboro, Oregon. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I studied physics in college, and my professors told me that no great discoveries were made by anybody over the age of 25. I was wondering if your research confirmed that.
No, that's certainly not true. I think Max Planck was about 42 when he discovered the quantum. It is true that the great discoveries in science are usually made when the person is in their 30s. So I would put the limit higher than age 25. Einstein was 26. There are some discoveries that are made at a later age. But I would agree with the general trend that in science the discoveries are made at a younger age than, say, the age at which great novels are written or great symphonies are composed.
Thanks for calling.
Great, thanks.
Right, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Alan Lightman, author of The Discoveries, Great Breakthroughs in the 20th Century Science, including the original papers right in there with them, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. It's interesting that you must have had to put a cutoff point in the 20th century where you stopped looking, right, for searching.
That's right.
What was
right.
that, and why? And why did you do that?
Well, I think that just as you need a few decades to judge the impact of a great work of art, you need a few decades to measure the impact of a great scientific discovery. And the last discovery that I included in the book was the discovery by Paul Berg of Stanford of recombinant DNA in 1972. Berg and his colleagues were the first people to join the DNA of two different organisms to create an altered form of life. And I'm sure that there have been important discoveries since 1972, but I didn't feel that I could evaluate that importance because not enough time has elapsed. So I stopped in 1972.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. You also mentioned that there are so many different ways for discoveries to happen, and including having a dream about one.
Yes. One of the discoveries I included in my book was made by the German physiologist Otto Loewi. And Loewi discovered that the way that nerves communicate with each other, the way that nerves talk to the rest of the body, he discovered that that was by chemical means as opposed to electrical means. And he made the discovery by a crucial experiment that he did with the hearts of two frogs. He took the nerves off of one of the hearts and left the nerves on another and experimented with the two hearts. It was an elegant experiment, and he had the idea for the experiment in a dream in 1921. And it's unusual when a scientist has an idea for a great idea in a dream, but it does happen occasionally. There are other routes to discovery, but that seems to be one of the most unusual and the most romantic. Of course, I'm sure that Loewi had in his subconscious mind had been thinking quite a lot about the problem of how nerves communicate, and so it wasn't a total accident that he was the one to make the discovery.
You have a foot in theater, you have a foot in literature. Do you find there's a crossover amongst these two areas, between the two realities?
In theater and science?
Yes, in the arts and sciences.
I think there's a great deal of sympathy and relatedness, especially in the creative process. I'm a writer as well as a physicist, and I know in my own little corner of the world that when I've had a creative moment, it has felt exactly the same in science and in art. There's a feeling that your head is lifting off your shoulder, that you lose all track of your ego, you lose all track of your body, you lose track of time, you lose track of where you are, and it's a wonderful ego-free state. What's always ironical about this to me and gives me a laugh is that many scientists have big egos, like accomplished people in all disciplines. They're dying to get press for their work, they're dying to get recognition, they're dying to publish, and yet at the moment that they're creating, they lose track of themselves.
All right, we're going to take a short break, come back and talk more with Alan Lightman, author of The Discoveries. Stay with us, we'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour with Alan Lightman, author of The Discoveries, a new book out that it's make a great present, I think, this holiday season. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's talk a little bit about that, just to follow up on what you were talking about, that creative moment, that moment of inspiration. For example, Barbara McClintock, she said about her moments of discovery were sort of a subconscious process, that she would feel that she had the answer. Are there scientists who say, who have the eureka moment and say, aha, I've got it, and others who say, I'm not even sure I have something here, but somebody else will discover that I have it?
Well, it happens in all different kinds of ways. I heard on your program a moment ago, Hubble mentioned, I assume that's a new play about the astronomer Edwin Hubble, and his work is one of the discoveries I include in the book. Hubble's discovery was actually some data that showed that the universe is expanding. He found that the distances to galaxies are proportional to their velocity and moving away from each other. He didn't know what that relationship meant, that proportionality. It was other astronomers and scientists who concluded from that the universe is expanding. So Hubble didn't really know what he had discovered. He didn't know the significance of it. He knew that it was probably important, but he didn't know its meaning. There are other examples in the history of science like that. There are cases where discoveries are complete accidents, where scientists find things that they weren't looking for at all. but then appreciate their significance. Alexander Fleming's discovery of penicillin was in that category. The first antibiotic, he walked into his laboratory one day and found this mold growing on his colonies of staphylococci, and wherever the mold touched the bacteria, it killed it. And he realized very quickly that he had discovered an antibiotic, but he hadn't been looking for it. So discoveries occur in many different ways. Sometimes it's the eureka moment. The scientist immediately recognizes the significance. Other times the scientist has to be told by other scientists the meaning of their discovery.
And sometimes there may be a race on between scientists. Wasn't that true also of DNA, finding that moment,
yes,
the shape?
Yes, that's right. There was a race between Linus Pauling, Watson and Crick. Franklin was not in the race. She was not nearly as aggressive as Watson and Crick. So she worked in London and they worked in Cambridge. But Watson and Crick were very much aware that they were racing against Pauling. And in fact, if Watson and Crick and Franklin hadn't made their discovery when they did, Linus Pauling, the American chemist, would have done it within 6 months or so, I would guess. Mm-hmm. He did not have the advantage of Franklin's excellent X-ray photographs of DNA. So competition is definitely a factor sometimes in discovery in science. Scientists are people. They have competitive feelings. They have jealousies. They have passions. They have fears. They're like other people. And the scientific method, which is this idea that there is great objectivity in science. Science is sort of an antiseptic thing. That does not apply with individual scientists. Individual scientists are passionate and prejudiced and competitive and biased. The scientific method, this idea of having an objective stance, really comes about by the community of scientists who are very willing to criticize each other's work, even though they're not very willing to criticize their own work sometimes. Mm-hmm. Scientists are ordinary people.
Is the era of the lone scientist over, the one who's sitting there, like the Einstein or the other theoretical mm-hmm. scientists? Or are we now into the laboratory where two or three people work together on something?
Well, I think one has to distinguish between theoretical science and experimental science. In theoretical science, it's still possible to make great discoveries by one or two people working alone. In experimental science, the trend in science, if you're at the frontier of the science in physics or biology or astronomy, the experimental apparatus to do experiments at the frontiers is getting more and more complicated and more costly in real dollars, so that often now single institutions cannot afford to pay for an experimental piece of science at the frontier. For example, the unraveling of the human genome, or the Hubble Space Telescope, or the giant particle accelerators. These are experiments that cost hundreds of millions and billions of dollars and require large teams of scientists working on them. And so there is no longer the single scientist working at his or her desktop laboratory bench mm-hmm. making important discoveries. That seems to be, for the most part, a thing of the past. And one of the issues that brings up for me is how does that affect the motivation and the passion of an individual scientist who's working in a large group and only sees a small part of the whole picture? Does this idea of business of being in a large team, does that diminish the motivation and the fun of the individual scientist?
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to to Judy in Portsmouth, Ohio. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Great. I'm an English teacher and have been for 25 years, And over Christmas break, I'm getting ready to prepare a unit for my kids in English class on string theory. I got fascinated by it when I saw it on Nova. And so I bought the book that went along with it, and I purchased the movie What the Bleep Do We Know? And I know nothing about string theory except that little bit that I saw there, but what I want to do is take it into my classroom and show my kids that when I don't know anything about a subject, this is how I go about finding out and discovering. Now, do you think, I mean, I think that girls especially are more verbal than scientific, and so they're scared off from scientific things and scientific endeavors just because they're more comfortable in the verbal field. Do you think that that's true, and do you think that something like this unit of study might intrigue somebody and get them interested in something more scientific?
Well, I think it's a wonderful idea to show your students how you, their teacher, their authority figure, can acknowledge that there are things that you don't know and mm-hmm. how you go about learning things. I think that that's a wonderful role model for them to observe.
Mm-hmm.
That's a general comment. As far as science itself and girls, I think that the girls have the same aptitude as boys in science. They are, maybe more verbal, but that doesn't mean they have a lack of aptitude in science. And I think that what young women need is encouragement in science. They need role models of other women who are achieving in science. They need to read articles that are written by women. They need to see women scientists on television and so on.
They need women science teachers bringing this stuff.
Women science teachers.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Great. Good luck to you. You're welcome. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Bo in San Francisco. Hi, Bo.
Hey, Ira. How are you?
Fine.
Hey, I'm interested in that trend where, like, these great discoveries are typically made by younger people, 20s, 30s, wherever you want to draw the line. And I'm wondering if much thought has been given to why that is and what your thoughts are on why that is. I mean, we don't really...
Whoop, he died. He went off the... Where'd he go?
I heard the question.
Yeah, right.
It's an excellent question. And if you compare the sciences and the arts, where in the arts great achievement continues at a much greater age, the arts and humanities, I think that the difference is, and the reason why scientists often peak at a relatively young age is that a couple of reasons. One is that science requires almost an athletic mind, a limberness, you don't see any 30-year-old gymnasts.
Mm-hmm.
There's an intellectual limberness that is required for a scientist, which favors a young age. And the other factor is that life experience, having love affairs, dealing with debt, having a dying parent, those life experiences are beneficial to the writer or the painter, the actor. They're not useful to the scientist unless you're a social scientist. So living longer, having more life experiences, doesn't give you any benefit as a scientist where it does as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So accumulating years doesn't help the scientist. For those reasons, I think that there is this discrepancy in the ages of achievement of scientists and versus artists and other people.
What about the kind of support system that you need as a scientist? Do you have to surround yourself with people? Can you work on your own?
I think that these days it's very hard to work on your own, even as a theoretical scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're an antisocial person, and of course a lot of scientists have trouble with social relationships when they're young, even if you're an asocial or an antisocial person, you need to keep up with the literature in your field. You need to read about what other people are doing, other ideas. I think it's very hard for a scientist these days to work in complete isolation. That doesn't mean that you need to actually collaborate with other people, mm-hmm. but you need to keep up with the new ideas that are being generated mm. around the world, and scientists do this very effectively with the Internet and mm. have been for a long time.
Talking with Alan Lightman, author of The Discoveries, Great Breakthroughs in 20th Century Science, including the original papers, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Interesting topic. Let's go to the phones again. Let's see who we can get. Let's go to Alaska for Diane. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I was curious if you included one of it's a fabulous discovery in this century. It was that spawned a whole new field of biology called glycobiology. It was a discovery on how cells communicate. Gunther Blobel won a Nobel Prize for this discovery, a German scientist, and supposedly this discovery rivals the discovery of the human genome. Are you familiar with this?
Yes. Unfortunately, that was one of those great discoveries that I had to leave behind. There were a lot of great discoveries that for practical reasons I couldn't include in the book, but I certainly agree with you that that is a very, very important discovery, and I'm sure that different people will have their own favorite discoveries which rival the mm-hmm. particular ones that I have chosen to include in the book.
You know, other discoveries that are subjects for other books, the discoveries we don't hear much about are some of the tools that allow these discoveries to be made, some
yeah.
of the equipment, you know?
That's right. Yes.
Even from, you talk about Rosalind Franklin, she had an X-ray diffraction tool that she could use to make that discovery.
That's right. And that piece of equipment and that technology was actually developed by a man, first developed by a man named Max van Leeuwen, around 1913 or 14, which is a discovery that I include in the book. But he had the idea for that technology, and you're absolutely right, Ira, that the technology often enables the discovery. We were speaking of Edwin Hubble a moment ago, and Edwin Hubble had the use of the largest telescope in the world at that time. In the 20s, it was the 100-inch Hooker telescope in Mount Wilson, California. And other astronomers were trying to measure the distances to galaxies as he was, but he had the advantage of unique and privileged access to this magnificent instrument.
Hmm. Yeah. In about a minute we have left, and it's not much time to answer it, but I think I can anticipate your answer. Is there any way to predict the next great discoveries? Can you look it back in time and go mm-hmm. forward in time?
Well, I don't think so. I think that we can tell where the frontiers of the fields are, where the frontier of biology is, the frontier of physics, the frontier of chemistry, and know what areas a discovery is going to come from. But the precise nature of discovery, the kind of change in thinking that will accompany the revolution, that's impossible to predict. In 1900, we could not have predicted that just a few years away were relativity theory and quantum physics.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Lightman, for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you, Iris. Pleasure to be on your program.
Have a happy holiday to you. Alan Lightman is a physicist and writer. He's an adjunct professor of humanities at MIT. His new book is called The Discoveries, The Great Breakthroughs in 20th Century Science, including the original papers. Great book to have on your holiday list, I think. Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galek and Ryan Havers in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. If you want to write us the classic mail method, you can send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We're at lots of features for you there. We've got our podcasts you can download, and also Science Friday's Kids Connection, the free teaching curricula that we make for Science Friday that you just click on the For Teachers button and take that to school with you. Also, you can leave us email there and click on the other links that we have from these topics that we cover every week. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.